Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ole, ole. C'est la Peña Bayona, on est tous là, allez les gars, encore une fois.
So this game, if you were to watch it back on the YouTube, or indeed if you find another way to watch it, between South Africa and Argentina from the 2007 World Cup, begins in a way in which I kind of expect this podcast to end up at some point, with them trying to ask someone called Robbie to talk, and I'm having no idea how to do it.
I pray for that day to come every single time we hit record on this, and yet never.
There's a great moment at the start where the commentator throws down to Robbie Knock, the sideline reporter, who just is met with silence, with pure silence. And I thought about starting with a tribute to that, and I realised, no, that would just be dead air, and you just wouldn't know we'd started the podcast.
Yeah.
It wouldn't work as a bit. However, instead of that bit, we have a rugby bit joining
Very
us.
Very good. Very good.
Absolutely delighted to finally, someone, again, we've said this a few times in the series, but has been on the list of guests we want on this podcast for a very long time. Tala from the Rugby Bits podcast and website and everything else. How are you doing? Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Robbie and Will. Thanks so much for inviting me. Appreciate the invitation. Big fan of this retrospective podcast. Yeah, I think it's great looking back. And just comparing and contrasting, and just obviously the knowledge that you have now as well. So, yeah, very excited to get into this semi-final.
So, am I right in saying that this is your favorite Springbok team of all time that we're covering here or up there?
So, no, it's my favorite, yeah.
Yeah. So, I'd just like to kind of, first of all, before we get to that, like, how much competition is there with this team? Because there's been a few good South African teams over the years.
No, that's, I was thinking about this when I was watching the game. So my first rugby memories are the 1999 Rugby World Cup. About six. I remember the Yanni De Beer four drop goal game. Mm-hmm. I just remember this ginger guy just slotting drop goals from everywhere. I was like, this is cool. I remember John Olomou from that. 2003, obviously not good memories from a South African perspective, but that was when I started understanding rugby, but it was in Australia, times were weird, so I couldn't follow this much. The 2007 Rugby World Cup, I felt like, was the one I followed the most. So I was 14 at the time.
Okay.
It felt like that was when I understood the game. I mean, look, as you would know from probably the other South African guests you've had, you're pretty much born with rugby in South Africa. So my dad played club rugby. He was a referee. Like a provincial level referee for quite a while. He's still involved with the South African Rugby Union and like assessing referees. So every few weeks or few months, we'd have like phone calls and debates about the game and about who's playing who and all that sort of stuff. So the game is very much imprinted on me. And this team, I think it's just the fact that there was so many, well, it's probably a meeting point of the age I was at. I mean, I was a teenager, so these guys were absolute heroes. Like the first try that Habana scored, that dive, I had that poster of that in my room years. And I remember I had basically a full wall of posters from like the SA Rugby magazine that you might know from Mark Kiohan. And we apologize for that. and when I saw a poster of Jesse Creel, who went to high school with me, was actually the grade below me. That's when I was like, okay, I need to take down all of these posters because clearly I'm too old for posters now.
Never too old for posters. I've still got a poster of Alex Cuthbert scoring against England on my wall. There, I've admitted it. I'm 27. I think anybody who firstly follows the podcast or follows you on Twitter or just general kind of like the rugby media that you put out there, one thing really, really comes across, and that is that you love rugby in any form that it comes in. I think particularly you love the Springboks, the South African rugby and so on, but you love all forms of rugby, right? And I just want to know, like, you've mentioned that, you know, you got into rugby, and then as you were falling in love with it, the 2007 team, when you were a teenager, hit. Would you still say to this day that's kind of like the blueprint of what you view a rugby team to look like?
Oh, that's a good question. Sorry.
Really good question. No, you've stumped me there. I mean, it has a lot of the elements. And even looking at it from a 2023 or 2019 Springbok perspective, there's so many similarities. Mm. Like the commentators were going on and on about the Springbok rush defense. Check. You're going on and on about the Springbok lineout. Check. The funny thing was the scrum was struggling for most of the game.
Yeah.
Which obviously is a big part of what we do now. And there was just, you know, you have the big center, you have multiple playmakers, you have the kickers, you have the speed man on the wing. Your loose forwards are absolutely just going to kill you at any, like, if there's any chance of doing that. I mean, the amount of times that Skalk Berger did something and I was just like, oh, that's a red card. And then I'm like, oh, it's 2007. It doesn't matter. So there's a lot of it where I think I'm one of those people that says the rugby sort of comes around in a cycle. And at some point, attack will then be more prioritized than defense. Then at other points, it'll be defense that's more prioritized than attack. But obviously, South Africa's rugby DNA is, you know, big forwards, good set piece, good kicking game, uncompromising defense, willing to chase down any loose ball, and yeah, put a good, strong pressure game that'll make sure that we can always give ourselves a chance of winning a tight game, if not obviously winning World Cups. So, I mean, yeah, I think there isn't too many differences between this team and the 2023 team. There was a bit of a debate on Twitter, you know, Chasing the Sun is playing as we record this. I can't watch it because I want to get all the episodes at one go instead of waiting week on week. Like, this is not the 90s. So there's a whole thing about Chesson Colby and the charge down conversion that he had against France. And now there's a big debate about Habana versus Colby. And I've realized I've become that old guy that goes, you were there when Brian Habana was playing so well. In my day, he would skin Colby. These young people know nothing. So I think I've become, you love the SNL seasons of your teenage years. You love the sports teams of your teenage years. Yeah. So I guess this is sort of the height for me.
Yeah, that's it. I think we're the same with Sam Warburton. Whenever any flanker comes along, you're like, no. You haven't seen a turnover. You weren't there.
I feel vindicated by the fact that no fans from 1987 have written in and going like, you weren't there. Serafino Gizzoni was actually really, really good. Like, you know, we've not hit that yet.
But I think that's the interesting thing, right? Is the four Springbok teams that have won World Cups all have a very similar DNA. And it's exactly the thing you list of it's really good line out, usually the best defense in the world at the time, strong kicking game. And then, you know, as you mentioned, the specifics in a lightning quick winger who will score a lot of tries, sometimes out of nothing. And yeah, incredibly hard working back rowers, I think, is the kind of key thing. Is they're very reliant on flankers in particular who work their bloody socks off. And this like Springbok team here that starts this game is almost the archetypal, like perfect Bok team. It feels a little bit like when you read through and you see those names, you see the Victor Matfields and you see the, you know, even Butch James, who perhaps isn't one who's regarded as an all-time great, but is the perfect 10 for this team right across the board. It just feels like it's almost constructed perfectly to be what they want.
Yeah, I think another big aspect of me liking this team is I'm a Bulls fan as well. So
obviously
this was the pomp of when the Bulls were great with Matfield and Dupree, especially, are probably two of my favorite players ever. And I think especially how they beat Argentina in this game is they boxed it quite clever with Argentina and controlling the pace of the game. Yeah. There's moments where they tried to quicken the pace to try and sort of run Argentina off their feet. There's moments where they just took all of the passion and all of the pace down. Just when Argentina got that try in the second half and trying to make a comeback, the game became so turgid and so slow. And it just felt like we're going from whistle to whistle. So I think the best Springbok, well, I think all Springbok teams have an element of that. We have locks growing out of windows here. We have flankers just all over the place. We'll have someone that can kick 50 to 60 meters, but it's that sort of rugby IQ that, you know, your Matt Fields, your Itzebeths, your US Van der Vestasens, your Frieder Preyers, your Andre Pollards all have. And that's what makes, you know, I think those teams champion teams.
Something that really stands out at the start of the game is Argentina come up and they look fired up and they're aggressive and they're jumping around the pitch and they're so up for it. Where South Africa just come up and they set instantly for the anthems and they just look professional and like they're not fazed at all by the occasion here. And they're just set for this. They know this is just a stage in the journey. Where for Argentina, they know this is the biggest game they've ever played in their lives.
See, I kind of thought it would be the other way around, you know, that South Africa would come out really fired up and aggressive because of their style of play, you know, and how they beat Fiji, how they literally, like, knocked them out. They were so physical that Fiji eventually couldn't cope by the 80th minute because they were so broken by it. I kind of thought it would be the other way around, but you're right, South Africa looks so incredibly calm. And I think, once again, talking about kind of like the archetype of a rugby team, they have real key leaders in all of the kind of like key positions, you know. They've got a captain at hooker. They've got an already World Cup winner at loose head. They've got Matt Field at lock. They've got Dupreer at nine. They've got Montgomery at fullback. Like throughout that team, the spine of that team are the most experienced and calm and sensible players you can ask for.
Yeah, absolutely. There's one change to the team for the quarterfinal. So CJ van der Linde comes in at tight head for Yanni Duplessis, who obviously had arrived like that week beforehand. You've been doing, you know, the night shift and then instantly flown in to come play in a World Cup. They also bring Bobby Skinstad back in on the bench, who hadn't been on the bench before. Again, what you're saying about having experienced players, having leaders there, someone that had been there and done it before.
And this is his last cap for South Africa.
Yeah, Skinstad. Been around a long time. So yeah, gets his kind of send off, having been briefly off at the Dragons before this. Bless him.
It seems like there's also a running theme, at least in the 2007 onwards Rugby World Cup teams. There's always a senior loose forward type in our teams, in our 23s. Yeah. There's Bob Skinstad in 2007, there's Franco Lo in 2019, and there's Dion Fury in 2023. And all three of them have big moments and big games of impact in getting the World Cup.
And Dwayne Vermeulen in
2027. Yeah.
Inevitably.
But you are right. There's weirdly, I think it's, again, extremely Razzie coded, isn't it? That like you always want an extra kind of coach somewhere in the 23.
Yeah.
Something like that. And that was Dwayne Vermeulen at that stage. And, you know, as you mentioned, like probably Os Durant is that guy in this team that he's been there and done it before. He's about 4,000 years old at this point and yet still just as good. Again, like another thing that not many other rugby teams seem to do at this level. And yet really works.
Yeah.
I think there is, you know, I sometimes definitely can fall into those South African fans that are like, okay, he's played for 12 years. Let's let go of him. We can move on. There's new talent, et cetera, et cetera. But you know what? There has to be something for a game is tight or a game is on the balance, especially in the start of the second half. I was thinking, okay, I mean, no, obviously I knew the result, but it was like, okay, this is a balancing, a tipping point here. Are South Africa going to just fall into errors and mistakes and get Argentina in? Because we know from, you know, the previous games, how they beat France, how they beat Ireland and Scotland, like Argentina can be a big momentum team and can just score points and points and points on you with, you know, former team Fernandez's drop goals or just scoring tries, you know, counter-attacking tries. But South Africa was just like, no, it's fine. We'll take the pace out of the game. And how John Smith managed Steve Walsh and Steve Walsh's ego, I think that helped in the game too.
Yeah. To touch on Argentina a bit, because as you say, this is a huge occasion for them. This is the biggest game in Argentine rugby history at this point. Their first ever semi-final.
Arguably still to this day. They've been in two of the semi-finals since then. But arguably this was, I guess you could say it for all three of them, but arguably this was their best shot at it.
Yeah.
Even despite the opposition they're coming up against. You can tell that they clearly back themselves. You know, every word that comes out of Gus Pichot's mouth, like he clearly really believes that they're going to go the whole way here.
So it basically the whole country of Argentina had come to a standstill for rugby for the first time. It was a huge deal. Well, we mentioned last week, the biggest game in Argentine football had a delayed kickoff in order to allow, you know, the quarterfinals to play out and people to watch that. And then this week, apparently, it was all the talk in Argentina was about the semi-final. Can they go all the way? Can they win a Rugby World Cup? Can they, you know, take this home? And it was enormous for the growth of rugby in Argentina and it becoming more than just a sport that had kind of big cult following, it, you know, growing to become the second biggest team sport there. Really big over the course of this tournament. And again, Felipe Contepomi saying they were supported like they were a football team. He felt very much like he felt there wasn't that much of a difference between them and the football team when they're out in France and the number of people that came and followed them. So
and it is
huge for them, huge day for them. And a really terrible week for them leading into this. So on the Tuesday after training, the captain, Augustin Pichot, had a series of back spasms that then continued through to the Thursday and the Friday. And basically, they stopped on the Friday, and he was past fit to play. And it's one of these where if it wasn't the biggest game in his country's rugby history, he probably wouldn't have played. But they let him go. And then 2 days before this, again, on the, I think, the Thursday evening, Felipe Contepomi comes down with the flu. Manuel Contepomi catches it as well, as did Longo, the number eight, Gonzalo Longo. So suddenly you've got these players starting to come down with the flu. You've got four players who probably would be pulling out if it was a smaller game, and all of them opt to play.
That's just music to the Springboks ears at that point, isn't it? That's four of the most important players. This, like, aside from Hernandez, you know, if you say, like, Hernandez has to play, which other four players would you take out of this equation? That's more or less them, like, give or take a few. That it, we'll get into it later on, but it becomes very clear from, like, the start of the game that the Springboks' main sort of tactic is to break the link between Pichot and Hernandez. And the fact that Pichot had been suffering from injury in this, the week leading up to this, makes that job a lot easier, a lot nicer for them to do with the back row that they have.
There's a general look of just breaking Argentina, right? And you look at it, it's really strong Argentina team, largely the team that beat Scotland. So you've got the Contepomis in the centres, you've got Hernandez and Picho at 9 and 10, maybe their greatest ever halfback combo.
Ronchero and Ledesma in the front row. Yeah. Huge combo with Celso on the tight head.
The only front row that gives South Africa any trouble in this World Cup.
Yeah.
You know, they've
been walking everyone back the whole time.
And then suddenly they come up against these three absolute beasts, these kind of grizzled South American monsters. And suddenly they're in trouble for the first time, possibly in their careers.
It's the most cohesive team, I think, in this tournament, without as many massive stars as the South African team has. And granted, a lot of those were stars in the making at this point, who have gone on and earned that stardom by winning this World Cup. But yeah, like, the, I just feel like the game plan that they were playing up to this stage was really, really effective. And obviously they stick by it, which both works and doesn't in this game. But yeah, for me as well, like, just quickly got to say, while we're still on Argentina, form player for them is Ignacio Corletto at fullback. Has been absolutely outstanding.
I was just thinking when I was watching the World Cup, so Corletto was just a, obviously he was a standout player even from the first game. And I remember watching that with my family, my mom watching, and just sees this guy's like, that guy looks like John Travolta. So in my notes, I just writing when he does something, John Travolta, with like five exclamation marks. I think that was the time when
side steps like him too.
I mean, I think that was the time when Oprah used to do the John Travolta thing as well. So I think that he was front of mind, but yes, what a player, and just what a great, like, influence, and just your backfield player as well. Like, his ability to kick and return, to catch, to start counterattacks. Like, I mean, everything that you want from a fullback, he had it.
He's special, isn't he? Yeah.
No, brilliant player. Had a brilliant World Cup going into this as well. Just real standout. Yeah, the only change for Argentina is they bring Gonzalo Tiezzi in on the bench. Let's go with the same starting 15. And it's a bloody strong one. It's, as I say, I love this Argentina team. Just the balance throughout it. You know, both their wingers, Borges and Agüero, both really good runners for the ball. And Hernandez in unbelievable, the kind of form that makes Stephen Jones still go on about him to this day. and we should all listen to what Stephen Jones says. I was told by one of his 16 awards, which came to life and started talking to me. It is, as you mentioned, Tala, refereed by Steve Walsh.
The man of the match. The man of every match that he referees. You know what? Look, you can say a lot about referees now. We just don't have a referee like Steve Walsh these days at all. No. For better and for worse.
I take it your dad wasn't like Steve Walsh as a ref.
Not a fan, no.
No. What's it like growing up for a referee as a dad? How does that land? How is being told off?
Oh, so number one, Rassi is persona non grata in the house.
Really? Like,
post the whole video Lions thing, it was just like, he's not a fan of him. Wow. Because he says basically you don't do that, especially with him being in a sort of managerial position also in SA Rugby, like just putting referees in a compromised position. But number two, when I was still playing like in high school and university and stuff, I used to get all of this like advice from my dad about how to approach and manage referees, which I think worked pretty well. Like, of coming to the referee like at the start of the game, just being like, hey, like, we want your understanding about, you know, if there was a new rule or something, which there always is with rugby, how are you going to apply this rule? What are you looking for with this? Like, do you want me to talk to you? Can other players talk to you? So just doing all of the like the John Smith, Richie McCaw 101 of how to manage a ref. And it worked pretty well for most part. I mean, given most of the time your referee in high school games are like your teachers and stuff like that. But you know,
Sure.
I never had a problem with them. So it was, but in terms of just law interpretation and having like arguments, like we'd be watching a game together, let's say a Super Rugby game or a test match or something. My thing, obviously, with Twitter is you don't really want to fall behind in a game because you know you'll
Yeah.
it just throws you off. My dad will pause and will rewind and be like, okay, why did this ref make this call? Then he'll be like, well, he missed this call here. He didn't see this, whatever. Then I'd be like, well, I mean, what about this? And then it'll be like a 2-3 minute argument. And me realizing I was just like, okay, I'm falling behind on the Twitter like timeline now. And I'm about, you know, a few minutes behind, but we'd have to resolve this. He'd have to teach me, make me understand why this is rule right, why this is wrong. So it was quite interesting, but it was great in terms of like, I always say, like, if I can sort of debate against my dad and his views, and I mean, obviously, just in terms of generationally, our rugby views are going to be a bit different.
Sure.
I'm fine with pretty much anyone else on Twitter or wherever as well.
Is he telling you James Small rather than Brian Habana and Cheslin Colby? He's pulling up Chester Williams instead.
I guess because of obviously sort of the racial issues in South Africa,
Yeah.
he's more of a sort of a New Zealand or an England fan.
Oh, okay.
The England thing is
Interesting.
absolutely weird sometimes because I'm just like, of all teams, really?
No one
But
supports
swing
England.
low.
Come on.
Yeah. No, he loves the Underwood brothers. Like
Oh, okay.
that's his thing. Will Carling, Jeremy Guskett. So that sort of early mid-90s England team is his sort of like,
We can
that's
stand
when
by
rugby
Rory
peaked.
Underwood. He was good in 1987.
So if you want to be in his good side, I think his favorite player would probably be someone like Jeremy Guskett.
Okay. Nice. It's a classy choice, Jeremy Guskett. You know,
But fair enough.
and
You
I
can't really
assume you
argue
didn't
with
get his like brief TV presenting career in South Africa as well, which didn't go
that.
so well. Wasn't as much fun.
He
Were you
was
hoping?
so sour the whole time. Jeez.
Yeah, I know. That's very strange. But yeah, no, fascinating thing. And I think again, the Guardian ran a big piece in the lead up to this game, you know, during the week of the game, on the impact 12 years on of the Nelson Mandela story. Which obviously would be turned into a film a few years down the line and kind of grow in attention, I guess. But yeah, they went, it's a really long, really interesting piece where they go through and they speak, you know, they spoke to a lot of people in South Africa, a lot of sort of small business owners and so on. And it's online, you know, it's kind of on there and how that attitude started to change. And you then, I think, gives you an interesting perspective when you put that next to 2019, where it changed again so completely. And it's one of those interesting point. 2007 feels like an interesting point in South African rugby history because it feels like the halfway mark in where they were going. You know, it doesn't feel like it's quite there, but things have moved on from where they were in 95. Not to, you know, put words in South Africa's mouth.
No, you're right. I think obviously it's literally the halfway mark between 95 and
Yeah.
2019. But I think figuratively, there's still, and I mean, yeah, you could obviously post Jake White, Peter de Villiers comes in as coach, and there's obviously a lot of things that you know, were said and were thought about Peter de Villiers, about sort of race and rugby, about black rugby players. Like there was still, I guess, some form of like glass ceiling of sort that only a few could sort of get through. And you'd have to be essentially Brian Habana level to sort of
Yeah.
get people's like support and acceptance. So the change was starting to happen. I wouldn't say Jake White was agnostic to it. I think he was aware of like the racial situation. But obviously, you go to 2019 where like Rassie and Jacques Nienaber have dealt with it head on, and that's I think brought on a lot of people onto the scene. You have Siya Kolisi, you have the stories on Makazonwa Pimpi and Lukanya like that. There's more momentum and national unity. Like it's, I mean, obviously I was 14, so I can't really think. I mean, I wasn't maybe as aware of these things as I am now, but
Sure.
it's definitely. You can see like more and more of the country coming together about this, and it's really being a source of national pride. Then it maybe wasn't as much in 2007. And yeah, I mean, 1995 was cool because it was 1995 and how close it was to everything that happened. And 2019 was like almost a generation afterwards. 2007 is such a weird World Cup because, yeah, I mean, well, you mentioned earlier, this is, I think, my favorite team. This is still, well, the 2009 version, I would probably say is still the best team. I would still take it above the World Cup winning team of last year.
Oh, controversial.
Close.
I like it. I like
Very
it.
close. Very close, but I think I'd still take it. It's a, I don't know, it's almost like a, it just falls in the middle of the seat almost in a way of like, obviously the players are really appreciated. I mean, you know, that's a whole generation of like great world-class players, you know, but maybe doesn't have the love and the support that, you know, the more recent teams will have. Doesn't have the romance of 1995, you know, Matt Damon's not portraying any of these players here. So yeah, it does fall in the middle, but what Jake White did was to build a really good and solid team. And I also think it didn't, it helped with, you know, the 2019 team that, or more so 2023, obviously with the road that they got to the World Cup. But 2017, because it was, you know, Fiji, then Argentina in their first semi-final, then the England team that we beat by quite a lot. Maybe the, you know,
Sure, yeah.
the World Cup doesn't matter, or it wasn't as significant as the 1995 or the 2019-2023 one. So it's a very interesting team to look back on because I think this was the start of their journeys, I guess somewhat like 2019, rather than the end point, which usually with most World Cup teams, well, pretty much except for South Africa, because South Africa just randomly comes and wins a World Cup most times. But with most World Cup teams, the World Cup is the peak. It's like 2003, the England team went and all the way till 2003. 2015 with the All Blacks, that was the peak of their powers. This one was like almost like the start, and then we had a horrible year in 2008, and then 2009 we would beat the Lions and we beat the All Blacks 3 times in a row. So it's almost like the start of the journey for that team.
Yeah, no, you're right. And reading that Lions is really interesting because you're right. It is that 09 Lions team. That tour feels like it's talked about more than this actual World Cup win. That feels like, as you said, the peak. And when they went, you know, won that series in New Zealand off the back of winning the Lions series. And I think it helps that those first two tests are such incredible, unbelievable games that stand up in a way, you know. How was your experience actually of watching 2007 rugby back here with all the advancements and things we know now?
Oh, it's yeah, I. If someone ever, and I mean, I think you guys make this point even, especially with 1987, people must really stop romanticizing rugby from back then. Like, no, it's no, I can't. Like, especially just with regards to skill level. Like, I mean, look, I think we're fortunate with just how great of a level rugby is at right now. But I think even just with like someone like Pishaw and how he was carrying the rucks. Like he would take like a step or two every time he was trying to clear the ball from the ruck. And you're just like, you know, if you're doing that, you're putting so much pressure on your defense. I mean, on your attack, because now that's why probably Hernandez has to line so deep. That's why Contepone for that first try, he was so deep. He had some like he pretty much had to get the ball from deep, run all the way and onto the gain line, and then, you know, by that time the intercept was on. So I think there's just those little things in terms of skill that you miss there. Obviously, the pace of the game is something else. Like this match, maybe compared, okay, maybe it's not sort of apples and apples, but this match compared to like pretty much the majority of the knockout games in 2023 is like night and day.
Yeah,
So,
absolutely.
and so, oh, so many knock-ons. I think there was, if I counted correctly, 27 knock-ons in this game.
Jeez.
Wow.
So it was 18 for Argentina, 9 for the Springboks. That's unforgivable.
But yeah.
Yeah, even, well, knock-ons and forward passes. Steve Walsh was on the forward passes. I think he blew about two in a row. Then he blew another three during the game. Like that was, you could just see with the skill level and stuff. And I was mentioning before we recorded, like even just some of the law variations you're so appreciative of, like the 5 meters back that the defenders have to stand from a scrum, the passing back into the 22 and being able to kick it directly, like, you know, that's also it's a law that helps. The rucks are, you know, an absolute Royal Rumble. It's
Free for all.
Yeah, and protection of the head, you know, it depends. I mean, look, Skogberg was absolutely killing people. It's so crazy because I'm sure people have discussed this on the show, but Skogberger, like his he has really good metric results. Like you would think the way he plays rugby, he plays it like, you know, maybe there's like sort of oaf dumb type of person, but he got like really good marks in metric. He could have been, you know, a high level cricketer. For South African viewers, we see him on SuperSport every week. He's probably our best pundit at the moment. But the way he plays rugby and how he speaks about rugby is two very different things, because that man was just absolutely just going trying to murder
He's a
people. I think
psychopath.
he's not well. I think the first, I'm not sure because I mean the quality wasn't the best, but there was, I think the first ruck, ball goes out to Hernandez. Someone tries to run from like from the defensive line, shoots up on Hernandez, misses him, and then ends up like 10 meters back. I think that was Skalk. It was either Skalk or Bakkies. And I was just like, why? Why are you going so far to kill this man? Like,
I
geez, you
enjoyed
have
the
a whole
moment where he
59
fell over
minutes.
early on as well, where he goes to take the kick and he like tries to hurdle the advertising hoardings and ends up falling flat on his back. It's pretty funny.
No, he's not well. He is very much not well. But yeah, an amazing player to have at this
Oh
in
yeah.
this era.
You'd still take him, wouldn't you? You'd still take him. You mentioned earlier as well with Hernandez having to stand so far away from Pichot because of the two steps he's taking to get away from the pack and actually chuck the ball to him. There's that drop goal that he tries to force quite early on, where he has to go onto his left foot because Berger's just rampaging after him, like again, just ready to kill him. And Hernandez ends up slicing it. And like there's a few times that moments like that creep into the game. And because, as I say, like South Africa so clearly wanted to break the link between 9 and 10 because, you know, they're the two most dangerous players. They're the two players that will manage the game for them. And it is, let's put so much pressure on Hernandez that he has to take two or three steps further back to get the ball, take himself up, you know, away from that pressure and force the rest of the back line to then fall out of sync, you know?
So Eddie Butler wrote a column about this game in the lead up.
Yeah.
The late great Eddie Butler. His headline was "Prime Argentine Beef Has the Appetite to Reduce Burger to Mincemeat,"
Ooh.
which is,
Spicy.
yeah, prime Eddie Butler stuff. But the whole column is basically South Africa should be favourites for this whole tournament of the four teams left in it. They are the best team in it, yet there's no team in this tournament of the 20 out there that can reduce them and limit them as well as Argentina can. And I think, you know, he talks a lot about the scrum in particular. You know, he played in that Pontypool pack. He knows the scrum. And I think that happens. I think we see a game in these opening stages. You know, my instinct in the first, after watching the first 10 minutes or during those first 10 minutes, is there aren't going to be many points in the first hour of this game. Then it'll open up a bit. And yet, as it sort of rolls on, what we get is two teams that are physically quite well matched and are, you know, taking chunks out of each other in those early stages and matching each other up. And yet, South Africa are incredibly smart and Argentina are incredibly nervous because they're aware this is the biggest game of their lives.
Especially defensively, like South Africa looks so calm, you know, like if Longo's having a big charge at him, they're fine with that. We'll just reload, then we'll go again. We'll catch him on the next phase. Argentina go wide at one stage. Aguja absolutely bounces Fourie du Preez, sends him flying, and South Africa just do not panic off that and realign far enough that when Philippe Kontopomi goes to throw a pass, he really takes the ball to the line. And things, I looked at this and thought, like, oh. Someone's running a line off him there. I think it was Lobbe was running like a really nice short line off him there. And he goes to throw the long ball. And instead, Fourie du Preez comes out of nowhere and intercepts it. And it's such smart defence. It's so subtle. It's not like they're constantly in their face enough that Argentina would maybe like kick it away or whatever. You know, they're really patient in their D. And eventually they get the reward when that ball lands in Fourie du Preez's hands.
It's one of those proper all or nothing intercepts, isn't it? That if du Preez misses that, it's a try for Argentina. He's
It's four
flown out of
two, I
line.
think. Yeah.
And he's either got to come in and make the big hit or he goes to the intercept. And he reads it beautifully because, of course, he does. It's Fourie du Preez. It's brilliant and comes completely out of nowhere because you feel like Argentina have just got themselves on top after quite a cagey opening stages. And then, similar to, you know, the try in the other semi-final where Josh Lucy scores absolutely out of nowhere after a minute, suddenly South Africa have a lead. I don't think anyone was expecting to come in the way it did as soon as it did.
And like especially because he has to run a real angle to the corner flag because Agüero's got him for pace.
But he starts going to the corner immediately. He realizes that there's no moment of going, oh, can I make the post? No, I should run away from him. He just goes, no, okay, I know my own pace. I know my own body well enough. I know this is a quick Argentine man. I shall not test him.
Yeah, it's an absolutely outstanding finish. It's just a really good understanding of, I guess, like the angles, the geometry on the rugby pitch. Of like, I need to run at this angle at this speed to beat Agüero who's coming across. Like, it's just a really well-calculated try where you don't have to be lightning fast to finish that try. And he finishes it superbly. It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what was great about what Fari did, I mean, so Fari de Pre is standing at the number 13 channel, and he pretty much, you know, if Lucanio or Jesse Creel did that, they'd also be getting like full marks for that. The way that he, like you guys said, waited for Contoponi to basically make the decision so that he can sort of go into the line to intercept was perfect. Yeah. And Contoponi either had to deliver the best sort of like sort of floating pass to get through him or quicker pass to try and get around through De Pria. And obviously he wasn't able to do that because once, I think this was probably the first tournament where they did have sort of the overhead camera, but you know, France loves an overhead camera. When you saw the sort of the overhead angle, you could see the space, you could see what Contoponi was trying to do. And that essentially it would have been an overlap and an opportunity to score there. So it was like a 14-point swing. But how De Pria basically, because he started shooting and then he sort of waited a little bit and basically wanted to see how Contoponi was going to run, where these forward runners are going to go. And then he basically just picks his moment. And it was absolutely brilliant what he did there. And he, like Will pointed out, Agüero absolutely just bounces him like two phases earlier. He rolled back essentially. And because I rewinded a few times, I was like, was that Fari de Pria? And then he's the guy that goes and scores. So look, well done to him for, you know, surviving that, number one. But it was, I think how South Africa was able to kind of manipulate the Argentines with the kicking game was really good because they, even when Argentina was trying to counterattack, there was just always enough sort of cover defense. Again, it seems like I'm talking about the the current Springbok regime. The cover defense was always there. There's always enough numbers and there was always an opportunity to make a kick into a scoring opportunity. Yeah. And in this case, something that I don't think is done as much these days, that, you know, a good old intercept. I mean, the Springbok vintage was, you know, the kings of that intercept. Mm. So it was just them. Once Argentina was trying to now, you know, build phases, there was never a time when Argentina really got behind the defense because of that, because South Africa was able to just absorb the pressure. And even if, you know, people able to get over the advantage line, the next phase wouldn't be, they wouldn't compound that mistake. Like they're able to just keep the defense as solid as possible. So yeah, I think that try happens then. The commentator says something along the lines of, the team that scores first generally wins a semi-final. I think he mentioned that there was only one semi-final before that the team that didn't score first won. So I think from there, obviously it's now Argentina trying to chase the game, trying to create opportunities against a team that wasn't giving too many. And yeah, we'll talk about the stats later. But yeah, if you looked at the stats afterwards, you wouldn't have said Argentina's the one that concedes 37 points.
Yeah. The moment where I kind of look at this and go, like, Argentina are really going to struggle. So South Africa do this hilarious turnover where they basically like trip up every single supporting Argentine player around a breakdown. And then Skalk Berger just goes over it and just picks the ball up. Mm. And it's like, yeah, great, we'll crack on here. And Steve Walsh just goes, not even on my watch. Like, on most referees' watch, no, but not even on mine getting away with that. And so Contoponi kicks the penalty, and then straight from the kickoff, Argentina do basically the exact same thing back to them.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, you can have a penalty back now, Montgomery. And so it gets to 10-3 from there, and it's just the definition of a coach killer.
That turnover's great, because it is the thing you're saying about the separate the 9 and 10, where John Schmidt taking Picho so far off the ball, where at the last ruck, he picks him up and he's like got him by his collar, like he's a dog, like he's trying to pull him back, like stop him running off on his own. Dog almost on the pitch. He's trying to simulate a dog on the pitch. Steve Walsh is too busy looking at the scrap that follows that. He doesn't even notice Schalkberger just go and pick up the ball from, you know, an illegal position, because Berger's like, well, the referee literally isn't looking. He's looking at the fight happening just over there. So I'm just going to take my chances here. And Steve Walsh is happy the turnover. As the touchline steps in, it's like, she should probably have a look at the guy playing someone off the ball. The two captains scrapping with each other. And yeah, Contemporary knocks it over. And 7-3 is an interesting scoreline. Some scoreline we think something's going it. The fact it's 10-3 seconds later suddenly feels, as you say, like Argentina are... Perhaps to say, I think there's a lot of nerves going on here. I think there's a lot of very simple mistakes they make. Aguja drops a dropout cold. There's two scruff drop goals. There's a missed penalty by Contepomi shortly after
Ledesma
this.
Drops another one cold, like from a tap penalty.
Yeah. Ledesma at one point presents the ball on the wrong side when he's carried it in. He's presented back for South Africa accidentally. And there's a few of these kind of little errors creeping in. And the Springboks are the worst team you can possibly be playing if you're in that mindset and you're in that slightly... anxious approach, knowing how big a game this is for you, that they are pressuring the hell out of them. And they see Aguja drop one, they hang endless kicks on him. And Aguja leaves a couple. And then, you know, eventually he rebuilds his confidence, starts going for them again. But we see the box start to really exploit every weakness.
Peterson's getting higher in the air than he is every single time. Yeah. And Jacques Ferry as well, brilliant under the high ball.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, first, before the try, and even after the try, that first 10 to 15 minutes is all Argentina in terms of gameplay. Like, their scrum is working. The lineup hasn't started malfunctioning yet. The maul is going well. They're building, when they're not dropping the ball, they're building phases. Their kicking is going pretty well. Yeah. I mean, the commentator was making a point of, like, you know, the Argentines are going to try to target Percy Montgomery in the air. And it sort of worked. Like, there's times where the Saracens weren't able to field the kicks. Yeah. And you could see that the Springboks were also needed, like, a backfield, like, eighth man. Obviously, Donny Rousseau, who was man of the match, he's more of a lock than a number eight. So you saw sometimes they would put Victor Matfield in the backfield to try and get those balls.
Victor backfield.
Nice.
Of course. So you could see that, like, there's an opportunity for Argentina. They just need to get points. And they miss a drop goal, they miss a penalty. There's the one sort of like attack where I think it's Roncero is able to offload it over I think Habana's head. Then catches him in the chin, which obviously would probably have been a yellow card today. And, you know, they are not able to get that break. You need that breakthrough, especially in a game like that, where, you know, you can get the points, you establish a lead, you can sort of control the game from there. Once the box got to 7-0, and then especially once the box were able to get to 10-3, the game and the pace was all dictated by them.
Absolutely. And a lot of the best things Argentina do in that first half in particular are coming from moments of them being under immense pressure. And they get out of that pressure well, but then they have a habit of putting themselves back under it the moment they're not, you know, they're on their own terms a bit more. So, like, there's a brilliant break that Borges and Coletto combine for.
Yes.
Off a Borges brilliant kick by Foy de Priya. But, like, Foy de Priya leaves him in absolute no man's land. Borges just about gets the ball in time. This is bouncing towards his own try line. Sort of situation where you're expecting Habana to put him into touch, or maybe he, you know, Harry's a kick away and he makes it maybe the 10-meter line rather than the 5-meter line. And instead, he steps a banner and offloads to Coletto, who makes the break and gets up to around halfway. And then, you know, Picho looks to pin them back to kick them downfield, and Argentina start making mistakes and they give away a stupid penalty. And those errors start creeping in the moment. I think a big issue for Argentina is a lot of the core skills they used to, the things they normally do day to day, aren't working as they normally would. Where the things that perhaps feel like moments where they require the concentration, once they've got that core skill done, feel fine. So, like, the high ball is weaker than it should be, even by, you know, 2007 standards. And a lot of, some of the basic kicking and passing is not where you'd want it to be at semi-final level.
With the passing as well, there's so many times where, I mean, Pizzo was having, obviously, sort of a convoy of Springbok forwards all around him every time he got the ball. So all of his passes were always dipping, and like Contepomi or Hernandez had to get them from their socks, essentially. And then obviously you can see the knock-on effect from that. So anytime they even try to get it out wide or sort of, you know, start playing the ball, passes are just getting, timing is off. I think you're right with that, Robbie. Like, the mistakes that Argentina was making, they almost compounded on each other, and it just made things so much dirty. And then when the lineup was starting to malfunction as well, like, I mean, late in the game, there's a point where they basically would just tap the ball up and Ledesma would have to run basically and then tap the ball back also to Pichot, and then they can sort of start an attack from there. Like, it just, yeah, like there was, you can't really build obviously like a way of winning a game if you're playing like that.
Speaking of Ledesma, right, I think, first of all, he's brilliant in this game. I think he's the standout Argentine player. Despite the one or two balls, as I say, that he drops cold, he's clearly got some nerves to him. But I think like his ball carrying and his defence are excellent. Obviously, scrummaging, he's really, really good. Can we talk about the Ledesma intercept, please?
Oh, yes, please. Please, please, please.
Where South Africa had a penalty advantage from an Osdurant turnover that was for holding on. They play for a couple of phases and go to sling the ball out to JP Peterson, who's completely unmarked on the wing. And Ledesma, at full stretch, gets his two hands in the air, goes for the intercept as Steve Walsh is shouting advantage over. He clearly saw JP Peterson in space and was like, these guys do not need a fucking advantage anymore. They can do what they want with this. It's not my responsibility. And then it lands in Ledesma's hands and he kind of blows the whistle like, I'm so sorry. I wanted to not play advantage there, but I kind of have to.
I love that we got both a Ledesma intercept and a counter-attack from the backfield.
Yes!
Because there's a moment of loose kicking. I think it's in the second half, but still, there's a kind of moment of a loose kick under pressure, and the only guy back
from
there
Juan
is Ledesma.
Oh, wow, yeah. Juan Smith who did the kick as well. So it was a forward kicking battle.
The only guy back there is Ledesma, who has a, like a look up and considers the kick himself. And then he goes, no, it's time. It's on to run. And it's only as he gets close to the line, you realize like, oh God, this is Ledesma. And he's looking for literally anyone around and they're all still in front of him. And he's like, can I almost check in the referee? Can I pass it forward once? Can we let this go just once? And he gets turned over, but you know what? He has a decent crack.
Yeah.
The boy would be proud.
Indeed. Indeed.
Look, I loved, I mean, just seeing, obviously, I mean, Osterant is a legend, we know that, but Rodrigo Ronchero is also a massive prop legend as well.
Yeah.
And seeing him, both of them, I think, got turnovers in this game, which was also quite awesome too.
Yeah. The fun thing is, actually, no, because Ledesma's turnover, Berger turns it over, and the Springboks sling it wide immediately. And who should be waiting out on the wing? But Brian Gary Habana, which incredibly is his real middle name.
Really?
And I don't believe it. But there we are. Brian Gary Habana wasn't part of the Allen Club, which I always had it. That's a whole other thing. Quick show of his anecdote. Brian Habana once asked me what my middle name was. I told him it's Allen. And he was like, oh, no way. You can be in Mononu and Drew Mitchell's club because their middle name is
Allen. Oh, yeah. They call each other Allen, don't they?
Call each other Allen. Oh. And he said I could have been in their club. But yeah, I'm not. And for in my head, Brian Habana was Brian Allen Habana, which wouldn't make sense. Doesn't have a ring to it. But Brian Gary Habana, completely different deal. So anyway, he gets the ball on the wing and he goes for what I'd call like a speculative chip forward.
Yeah, it doesn't look like there's a lot of space for Habana there. It doesn't look like he's got a lot of time on the ball. And he slightly mishits that chip, doesn't he? I think he's kicking it off his wrong foot there. And yet, when it goes onto the wide angle and you can see how much space there is in behind and the fact that it's Brian Habana and you have to make like allowances in your head for usually you look at that and you go like, oh, the player's not going to get there in time. Whereas when it's Brian Habana, it's just like, oh, well, his pace over 10 meters is genuinely better than any other rugby player I've ever seen. Like his sheer acceleration. I can't think of a rugby player who has that level of like getting to the top speed straight away. And so suddenly you see that ball starting to bounce. You're like, oh, wait, this is going to be a try, isn't it?
Yeah. It suddenly sits up for him and he hits it perfectly. That very Brian Habana thing of just accelerating at exactly the right moment, coming straight onto the ball, taking it right as he hits full pace and running it in from there.
Yeah, I mean, he's a fiend in terms of just breaking out and be able to score those sort of tries. Like, yeah, obviously he's just pace personified. And I have to say it, but you know, he did see when he made that chip that, you know, I think there were two props there, the Argentine props were around him. Yeah. And I'm not sure. I think it was the Argentine 11 that found himself there because that try came from a bit of ping pong and a bit of kicking tennis. And then obviously Skull had the turnover and the ball went wide. And, you know, as we know now, Abana's able to identify someone that's slow to the turn. So had to do it. So, you know, once he put the kick behind, and like you said, once he saw the space that was available to him, I was like, okay, this is going to be quite an easy try. But I was just like, this guy pretty much made, especially in that sort of early stage of the banner, because I think the commentator said he had 30 tries at that stage after about 30 odd tests or something crazy like that, like a Julian Sevilla level of like strike rate. And that was essentially what Habana would do, is either intercept the ball, as we saw later, or was pretty much the person that said, I will put the ball ahead of everyone. I will pace everyone here. So there's no chance you can catch me. And he's the most like PlayStation 2 player ever.
Yes.
The way he runs, I mean, I've had many arguments with people before. I don't think Habana has a step. I don't think he's not Chesney Colby. He's not Kudla. No. So he's not going to sidestep a defender one-on-one. He just runs in that sort of arcing way that like a PlayStation player plays. Like you just go, pace 99, I'm in space, I will beat you. And that was basically what Brian Habana did there.
Or like he'd slam on the brakes and run in the other direction, wouldn't he? Like Seven style, you know? But you're right. Like he never really needed to sidestep. I never really considered that. Because he was that level of like acceleration and speed. And I can't believe you've cracked it that Lucas Borges was the man who was slow on the turn.
Yeah, that's it.
Gave Brian Habana a competitive advantage in life and in business.
We finally got to the bottom of this mystery. People have been wondering this for years and years of every game of rugby played. And yet here we are. Yeah, takes Brian Habana 7 tries in the tournament, second only to Jonah Lomu, as it stood, who scored 8 tries in the 95 World Cup.
Who was there as well.
Yeah, who was in the crowd. I love that they constantly show Brian Habana. No, sorry, of course he's showing Brian Habana was playing. Jonah Lomu, yeah. If Lomu was in the crowd, he is shown every single time.
And
as
rightfully
he should be.
So. Yeah.
As he should be, yeah. So yeah, who knows if Brian Habana can equal that record and if it will still stand today and later get equaled by Julian Savera and Will Jordan. Who can know? Who can possibly know that? Who knows if he'll go on to be named World Player of the Year and this following this and his winning try in Super Rugby in the final and all of that that he did?
Who knows?
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't
Can
know.
I stop there, Robbie?
Please.
Okay, the 2 minutes I have to rub it into Sharks fans that will listen to this. As a 13-year-old and a bit of background, my family moves to KwaZulu-Natal, which is where the Sharks are from. Mm-hmm. So I'm entering high school at the time, and I'm in a high school, obviously, where 99% of people support the Sharks. And I'm a Bulls fan. Bulls go all the way to the final. We're at Kings Park. I wasn't able to go to the match, but I was watching at home and Sharks are winning that game. I'm like, Monday's going to be hell because, especially in high school, that Monday when your team loses is the worst day ever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then Brian Habana will always have my heart because of that, because he scores a try basically doing the whole PlayStation thing of run, 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 run through people, through a gap that I didn't even know was there, scores the try, and I can just remind Sharks fans every few months when they play that try, like when SuperSport has like a clip from that try or something like that. And there's not, like I think as you grow older, these sports memories, you can sort of contextualize them, have a bit of perspective. But a 14-year-old and your team wins a competition that you never thought they'd be able to win, pretty much near the top of like the moments of my sports watching life.
As Welsh fans who grew up in England, we get that. We get stakes of that in school going on in the morning.
Grown up in a non-rugby area of England, the only time in which people cared about rugby every year was the week after Wales beat England. No, England beat Wales. Suddenly it became a stick to beat me with. Again, as it should be.
Absolutely. So I'm very, very pleased that you got that moment. And good on you for using this platform to gloat about it. We're very 100%. Much in favour of that.
I know the people, the Sharks fans that are listening, I'm going to remind you again of the worst moment of your lives watching rugby. It was 2007, when you thought you'd win a Super Rugby title and you haven't. You still think you're going to win a URC, you won't because your team's an absolute mess. Like, just want to push that stake in just a little bit deeper every time I have the chance.
I think, looking at the Sharks this season, I think there's a few worse moments coming for them at the minute. I think they can still say at least we made the final there. They're not battling the Dragons to be bottom of the table. But yeah, although they could yet win a Challenge Cup, which I would I would call irrelevant were it not for the fact I'm incredibly invested in the Ospreys winning it. But that's a whole other that's a whole other matter. It will matter only if the team I like wins it. Yeah, that's how it works. The challenge, I don't make up the rules. So the commentary on the Pabana try is shit.
Oh yeah.
Start saying, yeah, this try should be disallowed. Oh no, I think if the try wasn't allowed, then they could have come back for penalty. The commentators start saying, I thought there might have been a pull. I don't care. The try's just been scored. They've just
taken
control.
And it's like a legendary
yeah.
World Cup try by a yeah. legendary yeah. World Cup player.
This is a try that is described in detail on Brian Habana's Wikipedia page. Is that notable? And the guy commentating at the time is too busy complaining to the referee about something that didn't happen.
And the referee, Steve Walsh, what do you expect him to do? Yeah. Pick up on things and like actually referee them properly? No. Piss off. Watch a different
Look,
game.
The big screen wasn't showing him, so he wasn't paying attention to anything.
Nope.
Yeah.
I thought at the start that he was saying that someone's pulling Habana back.
Yeah.
And then I was like, no, they complained about someone pulling the Argentine defender back. I was like, look, okay, fair, but they're not catching Habana as well.
No, yeah. the try's grand. The try stands. The try is given.
And the try's unbelievable. And Brian Habana does a great dive at the end of it that was on your bedroom wall for years to come.
For many years, basically. So yeah, that was obviously just a high point in that game. And it felt like, okay, if Argentina's going to win and they have to get two scores, it's looking close to impossible at that stage. And then obviously there's more to come.
Yeah.
Of course, a moment that I'm sure was on many, many South Africans' bedroom walls for years to come was Frans Steyn's drop goal attempt in the first half. I'm sure that was a really, really great moment where South Africa, like, are putting Argentina under the cosh a little bit, get the ball like in touch, but do a quick throw in. And Frans Steyn has stood there 5 metres from the touchline, about, I'd say, probably about 45, 46 metres out from the goal line, and goes, I fancy another pop at this.
Why
and
not?
Ordinarily, I'd look at this and go like, you know what, Frans Steyn, he's got a hell of a boot. It's a massive boot. I've seen him get stuff like this before. However, the previous week, as we discussed with Ryan Lowe, Frans Steyn is playing like a dickhead at this moment in his career, where he is extremely, like, cockily confident in absolutely everything he does. And that's not a bad thing. It's much better than being the opposite and being really timid in everything you do at a World Cup semi-final. And he goes for this with absolutely, like, massive stones on him, right? And as soon as he swings his leg, like, the ball barely gets off the floor. And it's like, come on, Frans Steyn, at least send it absolutely miles into row Z if you're going to go for this.
Yeah, you see the 20-year-old Frans Steyn. I mean, arguably some of those things never really went away with France, but there's a player with an insane amount of confidence that's basically saying to the rest of the team, guys, I can take the 60-meter penalty. I will take this drop goal from, you know, another country. Like, I will run up and do a crash ball, even though I'm like 20 years old. This 2007 World Cup, I mean, the commentators say somewhere in the second half that they think Frans Steyn and Jacques Free are the best World Cup centre combination. And it's a crazy thing to think about because obviously Jean de Vélez is supposed to be there. He gets injured. Frans Steyn has barely passed high school and he's, I'm not talking about his grades. I don't know his grades. But he's in this team now. And yeah, I think it's just, I guess in some ways it worked out well because you just need, I think a backline needs a dickhead. A backline needs someone is very selfish, very much, I'm going to try to get my own. Habana had a bit of that because Habana would also, like, if he got the ball, he would do his chip thing and I'd just be like, okay, it works 5% of the, or like 5 out of 10 times, not all the time. So, but Frans Steyn was very much in his bag of like, you know what, anytime the ball comes to me and there's a chance of a drop goal, if, you know, I'm in any way in a rugby stadium, I'm going to go for it, man. You're not fierce to him. And I was just taking myself back when I saw him like line it up. I think at that stage, every South African had the belief that, you know, he can do this. Like, this is basically a kick. I mean, even to the point in the 2019 World Cup, there was a lot, or even post that, when he was still playing for the Box, there's a lot of, you know what, the 50-22 law was made for him. I'm still a bit disappointed that we didn't make him kick as much as he could have then. But there was that whole thing of like, you know, Frans Steyn can kick from 65 meters. When late in his career, it was quite clear that the juice was gone from his legs. Like, he couldn't really get, you know, the ball all the way through. But I think Zarafka still had that like irrational belief that, you know, if it's pretty much within, you know, provincial lines, like Frankenstein is able to get that kick through.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you then throw into all of that Argentina making further errors. They get a free kick from a scrum at one point. They take it quickly and they drop it cold. They just knock it on. And these errors are just creeping further and further into their game until Hernandez drops one cold right as we get on to like 39 minutes.
Yeah.
And the Springboks get to work. They regather, and it's a sequence of lovely offloads. It's a try for the people who thought this was a very contained and slow Springbok team. Because when they smell blood, they will find a way to extract it, even if that requires playing Fijian rugby.
100% that. Again, it's a product of Hernandez having to take another further couple of steps back from Pichot because of the amount of pressure that Argentina have been putting on him all game. And the ball just really dips on Habana at the last moment with Pichot's pass that's having to go sort of 20, 30 metres back into the back line. And as you say, fumbles it along the floor. Who is it that picks it up in the end? Is it Juan Smith?
I think it's Juan Smith,
Who offloads to Jacques Ferry, who's on that, runs a really good line, Jacques Ferry, really anticipates this and gets the offload into Skulkberger. And I love Skulkberger's touch on this.
This is the start of, I think, in two World Cups to come, the Skulkberger, Heinke may basically use Skulkberger as first receiver pretty much every phase of that Springbok run. And this was like, I saw that pass and I was like, oh yeah, I guess that's what Heineken Meyer saw a few years down the line. But yeah, he puts Donny Rousseau away. And it was just that, like, again, sort of going back to the template conversation we had earlier, a good Springbok team is able to turn those pressure moments, obviously put you under pressure in the first place, but they're able to sort of click into gear and turn that pressure into points. And, you know, now it's a... It's 24-3 game, essentially.
Yeah.
And the Springboks have turned five missed tackles at this time, at half time. No, sorry, two missed tackles at half time into three tries, which is absolutely ridiculous.
That's insane, isn't it? Again, like it shows there are moments like Berger's offload to Rousseau there for that try that don't require a missed tackle, but just require you dominating a collision, you know, you being in enough space that you can free one arm. And South Africa had managed to get two or three of those moments, as well as, you know, Habana chipping over the top, Dupree getting his intercept and so on. And all of that added up so heavily on the scoreboard that it kind of kills Argentina off quite early on.
Yeah, they managed to force essentially three major errors, right? In the pass from Hernandez, where they just bait him and Dupree reads it beautifully, they kick effectively enough that Argentina strip back and they have no chasers and no one left. And it ends up with Ledesma carrying in alone and no one to clear out, leading to, you know, then turnover ball, Habana chipping, no one set further because no one's got across the other side, making it there. And then after so much pressure being put on and Argentina dropping odd balls, they managed to get this one where the pass is shoddy and Smith can recover it, and they exploit it. And it's this thing, right, where I think the second half, and it's something that Jake White talked about post-game, is particularly in the second half, they gave away a lot of penalties. But they spend the entire game going for these huge pressure moments and really pushing them and pushing their luck at the breakdown and pushing their luck on the chase and then grabbing and holding back players and trying to obstruct and, you know, getting amongst it. And maybe the referee will pick up one in six or seven of those, and maybe one or two of them will come off for Argentina or be fine. But the others, they're managing to push them back and scrag them and prevent their attack from working and put pressure on. And then as the game goes on, they know that maybe, you know, one in 15 of those can be worth points for them. You know, so you've got the penalty as well that they knock over is from them pressuring an Argentine breakdown. And they have managed to get so much change out of just stripping Argentina back and taking all the best bits of their game away from them. And then, you know, finding further points when Argentina panic. It's really smart.
Yeah. Them sticking to plan A, you know, because they've not needed to pull out a plan B at any point. And it really, really works.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
As the second half starts, the first thing I've noted down, massive respect to Horacio Aguja, as he, in the first 5 minutes of the second half, when his team are, 18 points down, starts a fight with CJ van der Linde as a winger. Like, good luck to you, mate.
Yeah, I think Argentina just turned full into, like, I guess, like, the mode where they obviously maybe just scores against them, like maybe starting something just to get them going, basically.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, I think the matchups were quite interesting. I mean, wing versus prop, interesting. I think the only one that a bit late in the game is when Manuel Contepomi was picking a fight with Brian Abana, and obviously it was just right under the nose of Chris White. And I was just like, you know what? Okay, fair enough. I mean, obviously we see the chaos that happens near the end of the game. So the start of the game starts with South Africa having a big opportunity there. I think it's Obaseti that's able to get into a line out, make a turnover. And then a few minutes later, we find Argentina down to the other side of the field and them able to have an opportunity of their own. Can we talk about how the ball just magically comes into Argentina's side? Because that was a South Africa line out. They set up the rolling maul. The rolling maul goes down. I don't know how, without there being hands on the ground, the ball then just is presented to Argentina's side.
No, so
someone's played under Steve Walsh before. That knows what they can get away with.
Steve rules.
My money's on Lobe. Or Longo. There's a bit that feels like a turning point, potentially, where Argentina are starting to cancel out some of their South African opportunities when they're going for rolling mauls. They're going to try and get the ball to Peterson, Habana out wide. You know, they're going for these hard carries to the likes of Schmidt and Matfield and so on. And instead, Hernandez is on penalties, getting the ball miles downfield. Eventually, at one point, Lobe comes up with a turnover, gives it to Ledesma on the short side, who you feel like would go all the way if he had any pace in him whatsoever. But sadly, it's Ledesma, so he just runs into somebody instead. But Argentina find themselves camped in the South African 22 for a little bit. And there's a really good attack that goes on really early on. Mm-hmm. They nearly blow it. But yeah, it's really good. I think Pichot makes a really good call of when to call the shots, when to just carry short, when to go for the pick and goes, when to eventually sling it wide.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know if we had the same moment of fear and frustration when suddenly Manuel Contepomi sees two men outside him and another man inside him who would score and goes, I will run into this one man. It's a 4-on-1. And he goes, yes, the one, please.
Oh, that annoyed me so much. I was like, no, you're not. Legendarily, I guess, for probably the right reasons in some ways, when that happened to Israel Folau in that one game, I was like, it breaks. I can see a coach just absolutely just, you know, if a coach goes and like leaves the coaching box and goes to cry in the toilet, I would not, you know, begrudge them at all. Because that was a clear try once that ball reached Manuel Contepomi, and he just managed to make it the toughest try. I'm not sure if he grounded it, to be honest, well.
There's one angle where it looks like a try, and in the others, it's far less clear. Yeah. The ball kind of bounces out afterwards, and you think, has he managed to blow that twice in a second? And somehow, you know, they award the try, fair enough. You know, they Tony Spreadbury, the TMO, for some reason.
He was never going to disallow it, was he?
No, of course he wasn't. He isn't mic'd up because they know if he is, we will hear nothing else. He'll take 20 minutes having a little chat with the referee. have a little word with Steve, be like, oh, how are you getting on? Oh, you're looking lovely today, Steve. All the rest. He's also, for some reason, seemingly the only TMO in the stadium ever. Because normally they're like in a truck out the back.
Yeah.
And for the first, you know, the commentators say, for the first time we see the TMO here. And he's just stood in like a little hut on the side of the stadium.
I really enjoy that.
Yeah.
Like, this, everyone's looking at him in the whole stadium and he's just there like, thumbs up. Yeah. Tries.
Yeah, he's just
good.
He's just like on his little computer and everyone's looking at him doing his little typing and being like, oh, look, it looks like he is down. Yeah, I'll give it. And look, Bitby's frustrated he did get it down.
Yeah, me too.
Frustrated it was given.
Me too. Literally,
he should be rewarded for that.
And I was just like, no, he has to pass that. He has to pass that. That's awful. And then I looked at the try being grounded, even though ordinarily in this point, I'd want a more competitive game. So I'd want Argentina to score the try. You know, I looked at that and I was like, for fuck's sake, could you not have dropped that?
Come on, guys.
Yeah, I mean, look, I guess it did sort of give a bit of like juice into the game. And I think from that, I mean, there was a bit of an attack that Argentina had deep, almost straight from kickoff. And then you start hearing the Argentine crowd getting into it. And I know you guys went to an Argentina game. And I wanted to ask you, like, how is it when those fans get into a game and start singing? Because even just from like watching it on TV or even like in the recent World Cup, it seems so epic.
Yeah, so they... epic. I would say, I think you probably agree with me, Will, but like they are the best fans. They've been, I've been to an Argentina game at three World Cups now, 2015, 2019, and then 2023. I seem to accidentally be following Argentina around the whole tournament. I think I was at like all but one of their games in the end, but they have the loudest fans. Yeah. And like the quarterfinal in particular, there were more Welsh fans there, but the Argentines were so much louder that it sounded like it was like four times as many.
On the way to the stadiums and stuff, like you'd get on the tram and this... To be fair, the same with all the South American teams. I think there was a real kind of like shared just way that they perceived their sports teams. Like Argentine fans constantly like jumping up and down, swinging shirts around their heads, singing songs, like the whole thing, like the atmosphere that they generate. I think the best thing to summarize it is like when you watch even on telly, the Argentines doing their national anthem, the people in the crowd are singing along with the instrumental bit before there's any words in.
Yeah.
They're all singing the da, 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 and they're all jumping up and down and like they're in a mosh pit when the actual words kick in. And they're singing their national anthem at a sports game. But that's how committed they are to bringing some atmosphere to the stadium.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant.
The best... I mean, you look at the famous win against New Zealand in 2020, right? Mm. And the noise, because obviously it was a reduced crowd for COVID reasons, the sheer noise that just the players who weren't playing, the kind of reserves generate in that game, kind of says it all. You then take fans who've traveled around the world and aren't frustrated that they aren't on the pitch and throw that in the mix, and they're even louder. It's amazing. And there's the one particular thing is there's, I don't know what it's called, there's a song that famously they will sing when Argentina, when the victory is secured, when they're definitely down to win. But they normally sing during the game. Infamously, in 2015, that quarterfinal against Ireland, they sang it with like half an hour to go, which was very funny. But yeah, like, incredibly depressing moment when they sang against Wales after the Sanchez intercept, and they instantly launched into it. Because normally, the vibe
like, I don't want to be here right now.
It's
horrible.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry for indirectly bringing that up. Then
that's okay. But like
every other time
we'd gone and watched Argentina, literally we were just like pointing at them, just going like, "How good is this? How cool is this? How amazing is this? How much you wish everyone else was like this?" Then it happens against us, and it's like, "Oh, piss off, guys! You don't need to do it this time."
You're right. You can leave it once. Your shirt can stay on this time.
Yeah.
Have some respect, please, guys.
What would Beaumont say?
Was this the years of La Presse as the chair of World Rugby? Who's the chair of World Rugby these days? Because they showed him. I think we are on the same page about our views on Billy Beaumont. But it was so nice just having a World Rugby chair. You didn't really know what his views are on the game.
Yeah.
He sort of just was like a very much an administrative person. Like, not someone's going to talk about rugby values and what he did in the 70s Lions tour. Like, I kind of appreciated that when I saw him.
Yeah. And
he was sat next to Bill Beaumont in a few games, though, in this World Cup. So they have been like they've been chums, but that's just, ooh, it's just, you don't get that in other sports, do you? People from different teams, different backgrounds, sitting together and having a nice chat about the game and the values.
It's what makes our sport so different.
Indeed it is.
If you asked anyone watching this game 2007, out of the 44 players that are going to be on this field, which one's going to be the vice president of world rugby in about a decade's time? How far is Augustin Pichot from that, from being selected here?
And again, he's spent this entire World Cup chirping at everything.
Oh, yeah.
Which has been great.
For refs.
But
yeah. Can we talk about his stamp, please? The great moment when... it's a little bit further on than where we are at the moment, I guess. But like, it's when Argentina are very much like chasing the game, you know, and he is so eager for quick ball, and he's clearly so pissed off at his forwards that he goes. I genuinely believe he's trying to stamp on one of his own players to get them out of the way and just say like, "Fucking hurry this ball up! I want to pass it." Yeah. And he accidentally stands on a South African one. Steve Walsh pings him, and he goes like, "I didn't stand on him, sir." But it's like he very clearly knew what he was doing in one way. He was definitely trying to stamp on someone.
Yeah.
So, do you want a fun story about that moment?
Go on.
Matt Dawson, doing the radio commentary for the BBC, almost walked out of commentary because he was so angry about that call. He said, "Are we playing rugby here? I don't understand that call at all. He's just playing scrum half. What's he doing? Walsh has given a penalty and I don't understand it." And almost stood up in fury.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's,
there was like
that's
3 minutes left
moment
of the game at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like... want to get an early train home, I guess.
Yeah, the Eurostar back. Yeah. See, they're still running at this time.
Yeah, I mean, in sports, obviously, certain positions have like their own like group. Like in football, you have the goalkeepers union, and goalkeepers on TV would always defend the goalkeeper, whatever they've done, like on the field. I think scrum halves are basically the equivalent of that. Like they will defend each other to the hilt if it means like any sort of. And I mean, scrum halves, obviously, we know what their characters are on the field. So they just find any sort of thing to be like, no, this is, you need to protect the scrum off here. You need to, you know, we're such an endangered species, essentially.
It's true. You might notice earlier when you were talking about Pichot picking the ball up and passing it after a couple of steps, I blamed the forwards immediately for not protecting enough. So.
No, there's all, yeah. I mean, as a former forward myself, like, yeah, scrum offs have a lot to say about like, shifting blame to either the flyers standing too deep or the forwards not doing their jobs, whatever the case is. But yeah, like I think once, and I mean, obviously, I think the racking rule came into force a few years after that, but it was like still at a time where you would see the odd stamp and it wasn't like too much for the game. And do you hear the commentators have that conversation about, oh, it's a surprise that Walsh would blow on this because in New Zealand, that's a common thing that happens in their games. And then the co-commentator was telling, like, basically how he's been stomped a few times when he played in the New Zealand team.
It's the high tackle thing all over again, isn't it? This, like, they haven't agreed on one law. And now everyone's angry about it when it comes up in a World Cup.
It always goes in cycles, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Should we get back to the game?
Yeah.
I guess we could.
So, Argentina, again, tries to run out. Borges puts it out on the full. And suddenly, you're looking at South Africa... not getting all the momentum in terms of like point scoring or pressure, but just staying in the Argentine half, like staying at a point where it's like, okay, now you have to do something. Now it's your go, you know. Butch James goes for a drop goal attempt, which is quite horrific. I won't lie to you, like it bounces on the 22-meter line, but still they're in the Argentine half.
There's scarcely a moment, particularly in the second half, where an Argentine player is making a decision and they're not under enormous pressure as they do so. Even then, Borges, you know, has an option not to run and he decides to kick and the kick goes horribly because he's put under pressure consistently. And that's happening the entire way. Players are taking it, they're having about a second, if that, to think. And then, you know, it's leading to a huge number of errors. And yeah, brilliant kind of defense and pressure game from South Africa. Leading to the moment that Manuel Alfredo, the Argentine coach, said was maybe the big turning point for him in that they are 11 points down at this stage and they're given a penalty, what, 30-odd metres out and very kickable position. And Corletto goes for a quick tap and gets and, you know, gives away a penalty for holding on the moment he gets 10 metres.
Yeah, it's really frustrating one because it's like David Soul has a bit of an argument with the lead commentator on there about whether that was the right decision. Because I don't necessarily, I'm kind of backing David Soul's thing. So like, I don't think it was necessarily the wrong decision to like to have him go and keep the tempo high. But I think then just running in a straight line into the nearest defenders maybe is the wrong call. Maybe you look to then shift that straight away, see if you can get your forwards running onto the ball, who can stay on their feet a little bit longer than the fullback could.
So Lofredo said that was, for him, the key turning point, the key moment in the second half, because he felt like they had enough momentum and they would get back into it. And I think he almost, from the way he talked about it, it's almost like in cricket, like South Africa set the target and they're now chasing the runs to build up those points. Mm. And he felt quite comfortable that South Africa weren't breaking down their defence. They were only scoring off their own errors. And if they could keep it without errors, then they keep going. And
I think if South Africa win a Cricket World Cup, it should be called Chasing the Runs, the documentary.
Nice.
So carry on.
Nice. They should hire you at Superb Sport. So, yeah, he felt they should have kicked the points and just keeps building that scoreboard.
Just
keep keeping those, you know, points up. And if it took four penalties, it took four penalties. But, yeah, potentially big moment that also doesn't feel like one at the time. It feels like a mistake by Argentina. We've seen plenty of those. And it feels like a moment of exceptional breakdown work and work rate from the Springboks. And we've seen plenty of those.
Yeah,
I think it's again exactly what the Springboks want. I think that's almost the formula for pretty much, like we said, all of their teams is let's have the lead and then let you try to play all the rugby. Because if you try to play all the rugby, you will make a mistake. And yeah, even with Coletto, like it's just the only problem that he had was no one ran with him because during the tap penalty, I was also on the side of the co-commentator. Like, I see the vision, but no one followed him. So, obviously, it's an easy steal. And in a game where Argentina really was struggling to get into the box 22 with, like, decent quality ball, like, because, I mean, I think we didn't, or we have talked about it, like, with the line-out pretty much falling to pieces as well. It's not like they can go to the corner and expect to get their line-out ball because Victor Matfield was at his pump with just absolutely just being in everyone's heads in the four lineouts. So you're just trying to generate some sort of pace and some sort of like energy into the game. And the Springboks are just able to snuff it out anytime there's a chance. Like as much as Argentina's mistakes were compounding on each other, their good plays didn't necessarily compound on each other because that penalty was from a scrum, if I'm not mistaken. And their scrum was quite good, especially they were able to put Yanni Duplessis under pressure when he came on for Os Durant. And they still couldn't really do much with that. Like South Africa's big advantage is they were able to sort of build some form of pressure or give themselves a chance to relieve themselves, like with their lineout, with their rolling ball, with their kicking game or something like that. Even the Argentine scrum, even though it was probably the dominant scrum, it never really gave the team some sort of platform to build on.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I give you an impression of how this game was going from a neutral from the time?
Go on.
So this was submitted to the Guardian's live blog by a Wales fan called Dan Jones. I presume not the Scarlet Fly half. It's a reasonably common name in Wales. There's going to be more than one Dan Jones out there. He submitted this as a beat poem. Okay. I'm just going to read it as it's written. Ah! 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 Sorry about this. Ah! 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 This is Will Greenwood's fault. Ah! I don't like the World Cup. That was published by The Guardian as a Welsh fan's interpretation of this game in the second half. I think as a neutral supporting Argentina.
That was 2007's answer to Lee Calvert back then. I take it before he started doing this kind of thing. Like, very interesting, but I can't help but agree. But also, it's probably not best broadcast on podcast forms, you know, that kind of take.
perhaps we live and learn.
Maybe we won't get Dan Jones on a future episode of this podcast, as much as I'm sure he was great at what he did.
We'll see. Maybe we'll get Dinky the fly half on.
Maybe we'll get Dinky on. Who knows?
We'll see. So, yeah, Kontopomi has a very mixed second half.
He does.
It's getting worse and worse for him.
Yeah. The kind of errors start to compound. He makes one horrible kick, makes kind of no meters off it. and we keep kind of ticking along. Argentina live a bit off a few of the penalties the box give away. Just the, again, I was saying, like, you know, the Springboks chance their arms a few times on things that they're getting away with often. And every now and again, Steve Walsh would go, oh, no, I'm going to enforce this rule today. No, yeah. I've decided. Yeah. Half Mate, an hour's passed. I'll try it this time.
The forward passes. He rules out that Habana try for a forward pass.
Oh yeah.
Like, it is a forward pass. But also, like, come on, Steve. Oh. Don't be a grass. Don't be a grass. It's such a lovely looking try. So aesthetically
it's
pleasing.
It's a beautiful try.
Let him cook, man. Let him cook.
And Eddie Jones special. You can see Eddie Jones' hands all over that try. Also, weird seeing Eddie Jones and not starting to boo him. No, because they kept showing it with Jake White. And
yeah.
I remember at the start of the game, they said, yeah, Eddie Jones said that the World Cup will be won by the team with the best defense. And I, for that moment, just completely forgot he was obviously one of the assistant coaches for the box. And I was like, oh, yeah, he said that for Australia, I guess, before they left. And then I see him in a green tracksuit next to Jake White. I'm like, oh, yeah. I mean, our secret weapon for this World Cup, basically, when Eddie Jones able to come to the team. But you could see there was, I think, about two or three moves that you could see Eddie Jones, Brumbies, you know, England later, like that sort of template. Japan, obviously, that template of like rugby move happening there. Because especially with that one, the manipulating of the space going back to the blind side from the line out.
Yeah.
Classic Eddie. The inside ball to JP Peterson. I was like, oh, this is something that teams should do more. And obviously, you know, should have been a try, at least for aesthetic purposes. Yeah. And it was unfortunate because Brian Aban just never got another opportunity to get his eighth try.
Yeah. But yeah, I had the exact same thought. It's the most Eddie Jones to ever Eddie Jones. Mm. It's that multi-phase strike move straight off a line out in particular. As you say, attacking back the
both
blind
wingers
side,
as well.
Yeah, counting on the forwards overworking. Yeah, both wingers having to work round, attacking the space, so many options available, allowing forward to bridge to just pick one, to just scan and pick one. It's beautiful. It's brilliant. And yeah, opens up and Habana should have scored it, did score it in many ways, in my mind, in my heart.
Usually you'd go, oh, if only Steve Walsh was reffing, because he would give that. But for some reason today, other way around, for some reason he wanted to ref today.
He really was on forward passes. Like, yeah, I don't know if that was like his thing for the day. Like, this is going to give me some camera time. I don't know if he was just pissed off on the orange that the refs had to wear in the World Cup. Like, it was probably not the most flattering colour in the world. But yeah, he picked up on that forward pass very quickly.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. So we're getting to the last 10 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Montgomery kicks a penalty.
Yeah.
Go on.
Really well hit. We get one absolutely insane decision by Argentina. Clearly, Lafreda's got the message on that he wanted them to go for the goal in the last one. And the next penalty is around halfway in the corner. Like...
Yeah.
The most difficult gettable kick on the field. And they go for posts when they're, what are they, 17 points down or something?
Yeah. Mm. It's very strange.
Insane decision outside Kontopomi's range at the best of times, on the angle, hit horribly, nothing comes of it. Just like, a really, really strange decision.
You get it when South Africa go for that because you've got Francois Steyn, you're taking a minute off the clock, like guaranteed a minute off the clock, and maybe there's what a 10% chance Steyn's going to get this, but it literally doesn't matter. Like, worst case scenario, you've shaved a minute off the clock, best case scenario, you've got three more points than you previously did. Mm. Also, at one point, Brian Habana rides up a drop goal and then kind of goes an up and under instead, which was really interesting.
I wish we could have seen that. I wanted to see the Brian Habana drop goal attempt.
It looked like it was going to go horribly. I think he made the right decision not going for it.
I wonder what analysis led him to considering that.
Mm, mm, mm. Was Habana slow on his own turn? Who knows? I was just like, when he was lining it up, and even the commentators were like, is he lining up for a drop goal? And he's just like, I was just going through sort of my Rolodex of memories of Brian Habana. I was like, the kicking game was not the highlight of the Brian Habana experience. Yeah. So I was very, because I was just like for a moment, like, did he go for the drop goal? And then luckily some sense prevailed, because I'm not even sure how it would have looked like. I mean, look, it was so much his like World Cup. There's a good chance he would have just got it in too.
Mm. Instead, he goes up and under. They do some rugby, don't they? And Argentina end up back with the ball. And they are once again in an attacking situation. And Gonzalo Tiezzi gets the ball in his hands. And he thinks... in that moment, of all the great moments of Argentine rugby history, all the moments he could be contributing to right now, all the great, great days that he could be leading towards, you know, all the Hugo Porter drop goals and all the Hernandez drop goals and all the Contepomi drop goals and all the other great moments. And what he does is he goes, I want to add my own tribute to a great moment. And what he doesn't realize is he's going for tribute to the one from the first half where Hernandez chucks a intercept pass to Foy Dupria, and he lobs the ball wide and Brian Habana sparks out of nowhere and rips it from the air.
Yeah. I mean, that was the Habana special at that stage. Yeah. And if there was a way to bring up the eighth try and the sort of record equaling try, it was probably going to be that way because, yeah, I mean, I still remember the Habana, sort of his breakthrough game against Australia when he scored the two intercept tries. And it was pretty much the carbon copy of this. Like, attack deep in the Springbok half, long sort of loopy pass, and Habana just sort of grabbing it out the air. And, I mean, it's good night nurse at that stage. And, yeah, I mean, with the first try with Dupree and Contepomi, I could see what was happening there. This was just a really bad pass. And was there for the taking.
Yeah. It's overplaying by Argentina, isn't it? Because they're in the last few minutes, and they're so far down. They have to get two converted tries to get back in the game. I totally see why he goes for it. It's a rubbish pass, and it's a really well read, brilliantly, perfectly timed intercept by Habana. But when you're trying to run something like that with a world-class finishing winger who is lightning quick on the opposite team, you have to know that that's going to come, right?
Yeah.
You have to keep that in your mind. And yeah, it's a brilliant read by Habana, brilliant finish by him, brilliant try.
The BBC write-up describes that, oh no, this is Matt Dawson's take, right? Said that Habana reads it like Janet and John. Now, I didn't know what Janet and John was, so I quickly checked, and it was a popular children's book from the 50s. So good on Rugby Union. Good on Rugby Union.
Great reference.
Reaching the youth.
Yeah,
because I was literally about to ask. I was like, Robbie, is that like a British thing that I just completely missed?
No idea. Apparently, it was quite popular in both the UK and New Zealand. Not the word quite. They were reprinted in 2007 to cater for the nostalgia market.
Oh, it's probably brought on. Then.
Purely brought on, no doubt, by Matt Dawson saying that.
Yeah, okay, he's been paid off. Never mind then. If that came up in 2007. It's much the same as in 1987 when they brought up Burglar Bill on commentary.
Yes.
You know, to describe Mike Harrison of Wakefield. But that's a completely different story. There's an episode where we talk about that. But anyway, so the last 5 minutes of the game, right, there are, and we might as well kind of integrate this, kind of, it's a pretty dry first 75 minutes for Dick of the Day moments, right? But it's an extremely heavy last five. Like, all of my Dick of the Day worthy nominations come in the last 5 minutes of the rugby game. It's great. I love it.
Yeah, this is the, as a noted sore loser, this is the time for sore losing. And I was glad Argentines took the opportunity because, you know what? They were fine. They didn't sort of go into sort of the Latin stereotypes for pretty much most of the game. But there was some small niggle. And I think, on a serious note, I think Steve Walsh didn't manage the game well. I think if the touch judge, is it Chris White, the touch judge coming in, there was a cool dad, strict dad type of like dynamic between the two because Steve Walsh didn't see anything. Chris White was the one being like, these players are back-chatting you. They're fighting off the ball. Like, do something. Please, like, get some order into this game. And then Steve Walsh would, like, go to the captain and be like, no more. Okay, no more. And that's all he would do. And I was just like, you're really not enforcing yourself here. So there's a lot of back-chat around the ref. John is kind of managing it, but there's a lot of shouting from the South Africans. There's a lot of shouting from the Argentines. Augustin is not managing it as well. I mean, let's just say the very least. And then it sort of just culminates and builds and builds and builds up to when, obviously, John Smith has that high tackle on Contepomi.
Yeah. My favourite just moment on that of Chris White is near the start of the first half, there's a moment where he tells Steve Walsh off for not reprimanding the captains. Where he goes, I need you to call both of these over here now and talk to them about their future conduct. And he's furious with Steve Walsh for not having a word with these two players who've had a fight. And that's kind of bubbling on the sideline. Like, as you say, it's almost like his dad in turn. Like, you got Russian doll dads.
Like his referee assessor kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He would not have gone good marks for my dad, I will tell you that much.
Juan Smith does this absurd high tackle. Literally, it's so high he almost misses it. Like,
it's
he nearly,
so high,
like,
it's a yellow card in 2007.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a massive fight that comes out the back of this. Albacete, like, pulls somebody's hair out on the floor and goes for somebody's face. The camera pulls away before you can see whether he, like, tries to gouge or anything. Leguizamon is constantly, like, not wanting this fight to end. There's a moment where everything calms down. The two teams are separated off. And Leguizamon just runs back and just goes, ugh, and, like, pushes Van der Linde in the back. And he's just like, what could he have possibly said to make you prolong this fight? Yeah, but eventually, Juan Smith gets a yellow card for
it. Yeah, Steve goes, this is fine. I see nothing wrong here. And Chris White's like, come on, Steve. Come on. Mate, we're not doing this again.
Please do something.
Just step in. Use your words.
Yeah, look, obviously, this was peak... near the peak. I mean, Skogberger has the eye gouging 2 years later, yeah. But this was sort of climbing up to the peak of Skogberger is a dirty player discourse. Sure. So even to the point where the commentators were automatically blaming Skulk for the high tackle at first, but yeah. Skulk is in the thick of, like, the pushing and shoving and the argy-bargy. I'm glad Bucky's Boeta was subbed at that stage.
Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
We know from, especially I think one of my favorite, at least from the South African reviews, is a Samoa episode you had with Jared Wright, where it was a competition between Bucky's and Skulk and the Samoans as to who's going to, you know, get away with, you know, something that's illegal in most countries. So it then becomes this sort of argy-bargy thing. And you can see post it, Kontopomi is pissed, which obviously leads to what happens later.
There's a great shot as... they show John Smith having gone off and sat on the bench, having sat on in the sim bin. And I look at it and I'm like, oh, they framed it very centrally and there's two sim bin chairs. Yes. Like, one of those looks really empty right now. And it's like
French director. Look, the French rugby directors get a lot of stick, but that was cinema. Like, just some good foreshadowing there with that shot.
Beautiful Kubrick stuff.
Just so you know, multiple players can be sent off at the same time, in case you didn't know.
A spare spot next to him.
Oh, it's so funny.
Immediately from the line out, which is kind of, I think it's probably not straight or something. It's
they overthrow it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Kontopomi's running to get the ball, whatever else. And there's a bit of a scuffle. And then out of nowhere, after the whistle's gone, he flings his arm back and whacks. I mean, it's Jacques Ferry?
Bismarck Duplessis.
Bismarck Duplessis. God, even stupider. Bismarck Duplessis straight in the face. And Steve Walsh then calls him over and immediately gives him a yellow card because he's seen him hit someone in the face. And Kontopomi goes, he hit me in the back. And he then goes, Kontopomi then walks off holding his back, like struggling to walk.
So
when if you watch
the
push back... You watch the push back, he doesn't touch his back. Bismarck doesn't touch his back. He's feigning an injury to save face.
Two important details to that. So you said that was started by a bit of a scuffle. The key word is bit. There is like, it's not proportionate at all to what happens. Like, they hold Kontopomi after the whistle is gone. But it's not like they, you know, give him a shove, like say anything to really get in his face or go, like, oh, what's the score, mate? Anything like that. There's nothing like that going on. They just slightly hold him. And it's so disproportionate just Kontopomi turning around and just going, yeah, I'll hit you in the face for that. But it is such a fly half punch. Like, it is so pathetic. He essentially, like, backhands him, like, slaps him around the face. But he thinks, like, oh, that's a knockout punch right there. But it's like, he hits him with a couple of fingers, which is, like, why it's only a yellow.
I remember one of the old Fox Sports commentators once saying that a winger punch should only be worth 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Kontopomi should maybe be worth 6.
Exactly. Yeah. It was so stupid, but so funny, because it was just so, like, disproportionate, and just, like, in what world do you think you're getting away with that when, as you said earlier, Tyler, like, literally, Steve Walsh was watching him do it. Like, he was literally in the eye line.
Yeah, and you can see this was still like the start of Bismarck Duplessis' career because number one, he doesn't try to kill him. Number two, his reaction to this, I guess, slap is he just looks at him like, what are you doing? It's just such great comedy. I mean, look, I assume he might be yours as well, but he's definitely my dick of the day. Just for, I get it. I understand it. I'm, you know what, a bit of shithousery. Bit of dickish behavior on the rugby field is not misplaced. I'm a fan of it, but it was just, you know, it was just that whole frustration of, you know, a big game, we've lost it, we haven't played nearly to our potential. I'm just going to leave my mark and leave here with something. And I mean, I don't even think he barely left a mark. I mean, that wasn't
Yeah.
really the biggest punch that he could have thrown there.
He didn't get ruled out of the third place playoff, did he? He didn't get cited for that, I don't
No,
believe.
no.
So, I mean, and don't get me wrong, like, fair play to him if he, with 2 minutes to go, throws a punch and goes, you know what, I don't fancy playing the third place playoff next
I'm
week.
going
I
home.
fancy a week off, yeah. I'm going to get pissed instead. I'm going to get myself banned. But no, I don't know. Let's talk about Dick of the Days while
Yeah.
we're here. So, do you want to do your first, Robbie? Because I've got a different one,
Yeah,
unbelievably.
so
Ooh.
you've got Contepomi there.
Yeah.
That's the obvious shout. I also want to mention Scott Murray, the Scotland hooker, right? Who was an expert pundit for this game, described as an expert pundit. And when asked what he thinks will happen in this game, he said, "This game does not promise to be wholly interesting." And you know what? That is just pure being a dick. And I admire it immensely. And almost for the sheer just kahutzah to say that, to say, no, nah, I think this is going to be boring as shit. He's going to miss out, but I think it was worth a mention. Janet as well. John, yeah, both of them
Oh,
definitely are contenders.
yeah, of course.
But look, in the end, it's kind of got to be Contepomi. Like, I'm not going to argue at all with, yeah, Felipe Contepomi for what he just did. But also, generally, you know, he shouldn't have even been playing. He was ill. He took those
Sure.
penalties, played like a bit of a dick, and then he does that at the end. Yeah, Felipe Contepomi, dick of the day.
Can
Well,
we quickly
go
talk about the post-match handshakes and when Contepomi goes to shake Scott Burger's hand and it seems like he says something, probably saying like, because they also got into it in the John Smith
on.
yellow card. And he says something probably like, I know what you did, or you got off lucky, wow. And Skalk just laughs and sort of like eases him off essentially. But it seemed like where everyone was like, okay, let's leave it on the field, Kontopomi was still, you know, I guess sore, well, from his back, obviously. But he still wanted, like, he was still trying to like look for a fight to pick on one of the Springboks.
Classic Contemporary. I love that. Good on him. Stick to your guns.
Absolutely. Leave it all out on the pitch, even if the final whistle's gone.
Every other
Love
sport is like that. Why can't rugby be like that too? We
it.
don't need to
So
shake hands
different.
afterwards.
Right, so I've gone for a different dick of the day to both of you.
Okay.
And I'm very surprised that I'm the only one who's gone for this. But again, with sort of like 5 minutes or so to go, there's a moment where South Africa kick the ball and it bounces just short of the Argentine 22, but stays in field, right? It bounces just next to the touchline, but stays in field. At which point, Mario Ledesma is once again covering the backfield, obviously, because why doesn't he? That's just the new part of his position that he plays. And he picks the ball up and he points at the touchline, going like, oh, that ball was in touch, wasn't it? And so he then carries the ball out to then take a quick throw. Except the ball hadn't got out in the first place. So
Course,
the
yeah.
touch judge sticks his flag in the air and goes, well, no, you've just walked into touch to take a quick throw. So gives the throw into South Africa. And it's genuinely like hilarious that he had no idea that the ball just didn't go out. So he just went and carried it out on his own steam. South Africa get like a 70-meter net gain from this despite not chasing the kick at all. Just because Mario Ledesma didn't know whether or not a kick went out and just voluntarily carried it out. And the touch was like, well, no, the ball's in play. You've walked out. I have to give a line out to South Africa. Sorry. No sympathy for him.
No,
And
that's
I
well
rate it.
deserved. That's well
Yeah.
deserved.
There must
Man
be
of the
some like Spanish poems written about the plight of the Argentine hooker because, you know, you could see Julio Montoya doing the same thing. You could
Oh, yeah.
see Agustín Crivi doing the same thing
Yeah.
in a like a losing effort. Like there's clearly one, at least one person on the field that's still trying, even if the game is basically without, like outside, out of reach. And that's the Argentine hooker. And
Yeah.
yeah, Ledesma just, I guess, somewhat starts or continues that tradition by doing that.
I love it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Man of the match. Will, do you want to start?
Sure. So there's a few written down here. There's a lot of contenders. Scott Berger, even though he got up to just so much antics. He was so amongst it that I have to write him down. I think Brian Habana, I think his two tries were taken exceptionally well. Both moments that require somebody of the level of finishing ability that he has. And my actual main two man of the match contenders are two people that we've not talked about at insane length, but we've mentioned just how good they were. One is Fory Dupria. Was just exceptional tactically, got the whole tone of the game absolutely spot on, was the heart of everything. But I'm actually going to give man of the match to Victor Matfield, because the one way that Argentina wanted to get through to South Africa, you know, I spoke about South Africa getting through to the 9-10 channel. Argentina clearly went, let's contest every line out, try and take the line out away from them. If we can disrupt that as, you know, a launch pad for them, we will win this game. And they're right to think that, you know. And yet, despite the fact that we're always throwing somebody up opposite Matfield, he took every line out cleanly. He was never tapping the ball back. He was just giving Dupria such a constant supply of just really good ball. And obviously, a lot of that goes on to John Smith as the thrower. But I think Matfield deserves so much credit for his line-out work in this. And yeah, like if a scrum is completely dominant and wins a team a game and they're getting scrum pens all the time, we give the title man of the match. So I think the same should work for if you're throwing your second row in the air and they're so consistent in the line-out as Matfield was and always is around the park as well, like tackling, carrying. He's always so good at all of that, but you take that for granted. So yeah, Matfield for me.
I like that a lot. I like that a lot. It's a very compelling case that makes me want to change my answer. No, I think Fory Dupria right up there as well. Matfield, you mentioned, really good. John Schmidt, I think, has a really good game as well. But I think for me, it's kind of down to two players for very, very different reasons, being Brian Habana, who gives them that kind of spark, and ultimately is the reason the scoreline is as it is. But I do think South Africa would have won the game without him. You know, I think you could take him out and they wouldn't win as convincingly. And I think he's maybe the player who plays closest to his ceiling in this game. But I don't know. Where I think Schalkberger, for me, is, as you said, the phrase is amongst it. There is nothing happening where he isn't there. And if you dropped him into a modern game and he gave exactly the same performance, he would have been sent off after 5 minutes. But in 2007 rules, he is just destructive
So
and
true.
everywhere. And Argentina can't really get anything going because they've constantly got this mop of blonde hair just flying into them and smashing them all the
So
time.
true.
And yeah, for me, Schalkberger, for sheer violence alone.
How about you, Tala?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you've mentioned some great candidates. I mean, I must mention, like, Victor Matfield in Pretoria is so highly regarded. I mean, look, South Africa's a very big, well, not probably say mostly Christian and somewhat conservative country. Like, there was like a picture of like Victor Matfield being sort of dressed as Jesus, and it didn't cause too much controversy, essentially, at NAFTA. So that's when you know that this man is essentially like a rugby god, for lack of a better term. So Matfield, I think, had put there. Fury Dupria controlled the game so well. I mean, yeah, it's good to have watch a game like this just to remind yourself, okay, this is why I think this person is still not by too much, because you know the Antoine Dupont footsteps are getting louder and louder, but still sort of the top number nine, I would take in like an all-time 15. And Skogberger was amazing. But I would give it to an underappreciated player, and that's Juan Smith. And,
I rely
you know,
that.
there's a big Peter Steph Du Toit, Juan Smith like debate. And, you know, look, Peter Steph has had probably, I think his performance in last year's finals, probably the best performance I've seen since like Dan Carter in 2005 and 2015. But when Juan Smith is good, oh my goodness, there's not much more you can ask from a blindside flank. Like his ability to just, I mean, look, if Skalkberg was doing the clearly legal things, Juan Smith was doing the less clearly illegal things and just like absolutely just taking people like off the ball, like when he's clearing out people, just clearing them out sort of just below the shoulders. If Skulberg is taking out their heads, he's like just below the shoulders and just taking out everyone. He was just ensuring that the ball that South Africa got was relatively clean and, you know, something they could play with. For Argentina, like when Argentina did have the ball and was building momentum in the first half, I don't know how many times he put in tackles where he just stopped any Argentine runner that was trying to make meters. So he was a big part of the defense. He was a big part in trying to sort of muck things up. Obviously, he got the turnover that led to the Dani Rousseau try. His jumping in the lineout, in that sort of the back of the lineout, was key for the first few steals and was obviously key in securing lineout ball for the Springboks as well. And just it's an amazing all-round game from a player that I think even at that time, but especially now, is like eternally underrated and probably somewhat underappreciated. But man, he does a job really well. And even I was listening to the Australian rugby pod. I think it's called Kick On, Kick Off now. And obviously they have a lot of the Toulon alumni with Ghetto and Drew Mitchell and stuff. And they had Johnny Wilkinson on. And they were talking about basically how John Smith would set the standard. And you could see how important he is, that maybe he's not, you know, the figurehead leader that John Smith is, or he's not as sort of all out there as Buckies and Scott Berger are, but just that level of excellence that he sets, like that was just a quintessential John Smith match. And yeah, man, it was just you see why people enjoy watching a play like that. So yeah, he was for me the clear man of the match. Then he threw it into a bit of question when he got the yellow card near the end. I love it when commentators give a man of the match and it's someone that did get a, like I think that happened with Kirkley Aronson in that test against the All Blacks in 2022, where he got the red card at the end for almost beheading Bowden Barrett. So it's like, yeah,
it happens to Joanne Van der Meer for the Six Nations as well.
Yeah,
as he was getting sent off.
I love those because SuperSport loves a montage. So they show the montage, and then I think the next play, Kirkley Aronson gets a red card. I'm like, perfect. This is so. Sorry, another small segue. My wife has this like. There's a lot of things about rugby that, because she's a sports fan, so she gets the sports thing. She doesn't mind it. But rugby is just, they do the weirdest things, like, according to her. So her thing is like, I don't know why the man of the match must be announced like 5 minutes before the end of the game, especially in a tight game when you're still not even sure what the result is going to be. So she's always on that case of like, a game is tight. Now you might have sort of the Joe Launchbury situation of getting a man of the match when your team loses or something. So she's always like, why announce a man of the match a few minutes before? But yeah, I was a bit, I mean, Dani Rousseau, I don't think we mentioned him. He was the actual man of the match, and I think he had a really good game.
Yeah,
I mean, the whole, like, having five line-out jumpers in your team with, you know, your locks and the three loose forwards was a valuable part of the Springbok experience. He maybe doesn't do all of the eight-man stuff well, but his ability to pick up the ball and still get meters with the scrum going backwards most times was really good. So yeah. I think I wouldn't have chosen him as man of the match, but I can see why. But yeah, man was John Smith.
Yeah, I love that.
No, very well deserved. Very well deserved. Yeah, we didn't mention Smith that much, but he's been absolutely brilliant all tournament. Yeah. And yeah, superb in this game again. And yeah, key player for them heading into the final. But before we get that, there is a bronze game to play out. So that'll come next. However, in the meantime, Tala, thank you so much for doing this. Where can people find you? Where can people find the podcast? Where can people find anything else that you may have that you want people to look at?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you go to Rugby Bits. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. We have a website. We release a pod pretty much once a week. We're busy doing a Chasing the Sun like review show where we like review sort of the episodes. I'm actually not involved in that because I refuse to be given episodes once a week. But the boys are doing a really good job. They're actually shown in one of the like trailers for the next episode as like people are talking about the show. So that's going well. Obviously, you know, it's in the midst of the rugby season, so there's a lot to talk about, including Jake White throwing a hissy fit about the South African rugby, you're not organizing flights for the Bulls to go to Northampton. and then only choosing a B team to go play Northampton on Saturday. So classic Jake White. So you can find Rugby Bits everywhere where you get your podcasts and everything like that. Myself at TalaMSutu77. So that's TalaMSutu77. Yeah, I mean, if you like sports, you'll find each and every sport that I comment on. So if you're just a rugby fan, just be aware that the NBA playoffs are starting soon. So I'm going to be tweeting very early in the morning and, yeah, having a lot of takes about the NBA playoffs as well. Arsenal's also going, trying to get a Premier League title for the first time in a while. So a lot of interest, not just rugby, but obviously it's the end of the rugby season as well. So at least for now, I'm still on Twitter, so you can find me there too.
I just want to quickly say before we go that all rugby fans listening, that Tala's such a good follow on Twitter and the podcast as well. I just can't recommend highly enough as well, because obviously it's great for South African rugby fans, like first and foremost, you know, the amount of deep dives you do on stuff like Jason the Sun and like the URC and all that sort of stuff. But also just, I think that you guys all have such a balanced view on the Springboks that it's not extremely like box centric, you know, that you, again, like just... all four of you have like a real passion for just rugby generally. So you guys all do such great jobs, including Jared, who we've had on the series already. And yeah, it's just such a pleasure to have you on this podcast. I think you've been such good value. So thanks so much for coming on, man. Like, really appreciate you giving us your time.
Who's your NBA team?
I'm a LeBron guy, so I follow.
Oh, nice.
Wherever LeBron goes, I'm there. So I've been with the Lakers.
Okay.
Yeah, they're not going to win the season. So I think my team now, as I'm still, I mean, LeBron's 40, so I probably need to find a post-LeBron plan. But I think I really like the Denver Nuggets. So yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So yeah, they've got they're the current champions. They've got the probably the MVP for this season. So yeah, when it's playoffs time, I try to watch pretty much every game and I abuse my sleep. I'm very sleepy in the afternoons, but yeah, it's worth it.
So the Arsenal Bulls double, and then that's doable for you. That's doable as a year, as we look at the minute.
Oh, it's so close. It is so close.
The only way it could be better is if you beat the Sharks in all the finals, including Arsenal beating the Sharks.
That would be ideal. Look, I mean, the Sharks have moved sort of aside as being a rival. Now, I live in Cape Town, so I'm obviously with Stormers fans, I did go to watch the URC final live at the stadium 2 years ago. Not great. Not a good time for me. So yeah, look, Bulls have a good chance of making it. I assume that's pretty much why they're prioritizing the URC.
Yeah.
If we can have our games in Pretoria on Saturday afternoons, I think we can beat pretty much any team in the world. But yeah, if we have to travel outside of Pretoria, that's when the problems come. So chance there also has a chance as well. We'll see. I mean, it's, I think I've become that sort of, you know, there was a few years ago, I managed to be unemotional about sports and just watch it and enjoy it and be a bit sort of agnostic / pessimistic about my team. And then slowly but surely, you know, Bulls got better, Box got better, Arsenal got better, and it sort of drew me into heartbreak. I hate the heartbreak. So yeah, let's hope there's at least a balance of cheer and heartbreak at the end.
Absolutely. It's so much better that way. Thank you for joining us. Thank you. That's been great. Please join us next time when we move on to the bronze final, France versus Argentina. One of the only two talked about and remembered bronze finals ever played. Well, we will no doubt, I haven't asked him yet, but be joined by our bronze final correspondent, Josh Gardner, the man who hates bronze finals more than anyone else on earth, to join us once again. Thank you, Tala. Thank you, Will. Thank you for listening. We'll see you all presumably next week. Good night.
Good night.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.